don't know if you know this part of my lore, but before I started Dirt and had to put it on pause, I was working on a book proposal for a book about how storage can basically explain everything.
Yes, you did mention this.
Yeah. And so part of it, like there was a whole section about cryptocurrency that's basically a storage backed currency.
So speaking of cryptocurrency and storage, I'm asking you to store this thread for just a moment because our guest is here. Oh, who are we talking to today?
Okay. Well, we're talking to Joe Weisenthal. He is the stalwart on Twitter. He has a Bloomberg podcast called Odd Lots. And he's like one of my favorite financial posters because he is fluent in the currency of like finance Twitter shitposting, but his reporting and the conversations that he has, are very substantial.
Let's have one of these substantial conversations. I'm going to let him in.
Yeah, you and I are so capable of that. Mm-hmm. Let's go. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
What's up?
Where are you?
I'm just in this little weird booth here, and I'm really exhausted, so I have bags under my eyes and the lighting. Anyway, how's it going? I'm excited to be here.
You do kind of look like you're in minimum security prison.
Yeah, or I'm in some sort of interrogation room.
We are interrogating you, so.
Yeah, that's right. So maybe it's all right.
Yeah.
Before I hopped on, I saw a tweet that I was not able to investigate further. Sam Bankman-Fried and Diddy are in the same living quarters.
Just choose to believe that that's true, regardless of whether
That's kind of the situation with any Diddy mention that I'm seeing on Twitter right now. It's kind of you can choose to believe that it's true.
I'm gonna put in a zin real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
No problem. Oh, Joe, I actually was gonna tell you. I mean, I tweeted this. I was sort of saving it to tell you on the podcast, but as we know, I don't have self control. I had a dream 2 or 3 nights ago about something called Double Zin.
Whoa.
And Double Zin was just a regular Zin pouch, but it's twice as big. But the ridiculousness of the dream was when you put it, in the back of your cheek, everyone's walking around with just this visible lump because the Double Zin is too big to kind of tuck up there.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I was like, I have to tell Joe.
That's a $1 billion idea. You should create Double Zin.
Yeah. It's like the double stuffed Oreo, but
Well, it's also kind of there's the whole thing mewing where people are
yes.
That's kind of
a lot. I'm disturbed because I get a lot of ads on Instagram for things like that, various gums and beef jerkies that are supposed to make your jaw more masculine. It's like, oh my God, what am I doing?
I inadvertently do it every time I chew gum. I'm not allowed to chew gum anymore by my own because I chew it so hard that my jaw is sore for days.
That's great.
Yeah, it changes the nature. It changes my face for a couple days.
Maybe I should try it.
I think
you have enough going on. You've got the beard.
Yeah, you can't even. I can't even
see.
How long
have you had the beard going on? I feel like
since last. No, I didn't for a long time. Last December was the last time I shaved, and then I realized. Decision. Yeah, I've never, it's a little patchy. I don't know if you can tell. I have a few, sort of bad spots. Mm-hmm. But I've never tried growing one before. And for a long time, I was on TV for a while and stuff. And then I sort of had this period last December. I was like, I have, no public-facing obligations for a while. So I'm not going to shave and just see what happens. And I think it's okay. I'm going to keep it for a while.
Keep it going.
The beard is nature's.
Thank you.
You know what I mean?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And not just a beard, but a mustache for our listeners. Mm-hmm. Yes.
He's got the full shebang.
Thank you.
Okay, I did want to ask though. So,
sure.
You used to be just a writer, and then you did TV for a while, and now I feel like podcasting is kind of your main thing. I don't know. I wonder if there's other factors here as well, how long you've been in this career, etc. How has each medium changed how you think about your subject matter?
That's a really good question. It probably
what the heck,
has.
Francis? We didn't even warm him up.
No, that's okay.
No, we did.
It's a good question. It probably has. When I started, I started blogging a little bit, and I did a few odd jobs paid here and there, starting in probably 2005 or 2006. There you go. It was always meant to be. But in my mind, I sort of marked the beginning of my career to when I started at Business Insider in 2008. Mm-hmm. And we were just
Oh, what true... an auspicious time to start at Mr.
No, it was amazing. I talk about this all the time, like, because yeah. It was an incredible time for media and the rise of mm-hmm. blogs and all that stuff. And then there was just like so much to talk about.
Yeah.
And I was like writing 15 posts a day, like a lot of people were who were like writing for various digital news outlets, which I liked. And like, if the opportunity arise, I don't think it ever will to sort of write like that again. I wouldn't be against it. It's pretty fun and pretty satisfying, actually.
My email address. So
okay. Good to know.
Blog.
You could start a new newsletter under dirt called Pay Dirt.
The problem is.
Don't guide me with a good time.
Well, this is good to know about. No, the problem is that like, you don't really, the problem is that like tweets are too easy. You know what I'm saying? It's like, do I want to like spend 30 minutes writing this blog post? Cause I could basically get the gist out in 30 seconds in a tweet. That's probably like what sort of killed my appetite to do that kind of velocity posting, but it's pretty fun. But like, you know, then it was like so much going on. There was like the US financial crisis, the Euro crisis, all these different things. And so like literally, you know, I started getting up at like 4 a.m. because I figured it would be a competitive advantage to start looking at what was going on in Europe before the US woke up, bang out a few posts, et cetera. For various reasons, that vibe ended and the need to do that sort of faded. The podcast.
Were any of those reasons having a child?
Yes. Well, I would say so I have two now. And in retrospect, absolutely. In the sense that I look back at that time and I think like there is no way I could have had a family at that point in my life. I was married at the time, but there is no way I could have been a responsible parent with the sort of work style that I had in between 2008 to say roughly. But when I joined Bloomberg in 2014, because it wasn't just that I was working all day, and it really was all day. I was working Saturday and Sunday too. I was working 7 days a week, and so there was no way. So
you
I
were
actually
addicted
think,
to the shindig, as I like to say.
I was addicted to the shindig, so addicted. And then, like, it took a little while when I joined Bloomberg to basically unaddict myself and to dive into things a little bit deeper and to force myself to slow down, because I still had that impulse like, oh no, this is how you cover news. You just write every second of every day what's going on. And it was a good disciplining effect, I think, in terms of thinking about things a little deeper and wanting to explore things to sort of be in a place where that wasn't really possible. And then I did TV. I was doing TV for a while at Bloomberg, and I was also doing the podcast for a while. And it was really the contrast. TV is great, and I'm really glad I had that experience, because how many people get to say, oh, I co-hosted a TV show on cable? That's fun. Like, that's a fun thing to do, and it's a fun thing to, you know, say at parties that you do that. But getting to talk to someone for an hour or whatever on a podcast is just so intellectually satisfying in the depth that that's quickly sort of where my more and more that's where my excitement went to, just because nothing can really compare to just time spent with that. And I used to have guests, like we did this thing where I would have on the days when an Avalanche episode would come out, we would have the guests on TV, and I would sort of realize in that moment, so I was like, oh, the conversation and the recording, the podcast was so much more satisfying. And so that's sort of when I decided I really just wanted to mostly, and I still write a fair amount, but mostly focus on the podcast. And yeah, I'll
for
probably do this
now.
For a decade, basically. And so hopefully, I see I'm 44. So 2 more decades of this, and then I'll be done.
Yeah.
I would say that.
Yeah,
decades.
I would.
The podcast didn't even exist 2 decades ago.
I know. So, I mean, I don't know.
Just
do you...
in our Neuralink, just teasing the
that's
Jaws
right.
report.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see,
I'll never. Yeah, I'll never stop getting up early on Friday, the first Friday of every month for the Jobs Report.
Well, there you go. Well, so, okay, the last thing that was sort of, I can't remember if, well, this must have been after the Jobs Report. You know, obviously, you were teasing the announcement by the Fed.
Yeah.
Are they going to cut rates? They did by, what, half a percentage point?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so, obviously, that was, I guess, an event on Twitter, finance Twitter, an opportunity.
Believe it or not, it was actually... believe it or not, it was also an event like in the real economy of trillions of dollars. It's beyond just Twitter. I know, hard to believe, but actually there was all this money at stake too. But yes, so, to your point, go on.
As the rare, not rare, but as a finance, an example of finance event that's both memetic and for people who are like really insidery, and then also like obviously very quickly trickles out to the broader culture and reporting sphere. Like, what impact do you think this will have on startup land in the short term, if any? And like, you know, I think most people's like layman's understanding of the interest rate is like, they were low and now they're high.
That's
and,
right.
And people attribute a lot of dynamics in Silicon Valley to ZIRP. And I think, you know, there's a sort of contrarian take maybe, or maybe it's the mainstream take in your world that ZIRP is an oversimplification of why more companies were funded during a certain period. So I guess this is a two-parter. Like, what's going to happen that a normal person could actually perceive off of this news? And does the interest rate really do what we think it's going to do by the time it trickles down to like how many sweet greens we have?
No, it's a great question for all kinds of reasons, in part because I find that even among reasonably plugged in people in finance, there's a lot of confusion about this exact question, almost to the point where I'm a little disturbed by it. So there's a lot of things going on. So I'll take a minute or something to give you a little bullet point in my thoughts.
Please.
So first of all, I would say generally, I think to a significant extent, ZIRP as a phenomenon, it's not a terrible shorthand to sort of talk about the economic conditions of the post-Great Financial Crisis era. But the idea of like the low rates specifically being like the key lever there, I do think is, if not probably an oversimplification, if not outright being wrong, because there were a lot of things going on. And to my mind, one of the most important things was not the low cost of capital, which was low for some people, but not low for others, because there's no like one price of money, right? So if you're a rapidly growing company like OpenAI or Uber in its heyday or Airbnb or et cetera, you just have people like trying to shove cash in your face for free. And so, capital is cheap for you. But if you want to build a factory or a new nuclear power plant or something like that, you have to really go out and work and convince people and pay them a lot more money for that. So there's no such thing, I would say, as a universally low cost of capital. It's low in this moment for a handful of companies. I think it was low. One thing that was distinct about the sort of post-Great Financial Crisis era is there was low cost of labor because we had high unemployment. And so if you look at a lot of the biggest names from that era, they're companies that in various ways exploited low cost of real resources. So Uber is obviously the prime example because you build this international taxi fleet on the backs of people who otherwise didn't have like high paying jobs. Hard to imagine that kind of company being launched at a time when unemployment is at 4%. And so I think this is like a really important dynamic. There are real physical constraints. Airbnb is probably another one. You know, why did people want to open up their homes to letting someone stay there? Well, probably because there were a lot of empty homes or people needing more money for their vacation homes or whatever. It helped, I guess, on some level that there are a lot of VCs wanting to plow money into them. But there was just a lot of spare physical capacity. You could say the same thing about WeWork, right? A lot of empty offices. You couldn't really build a WeWork at a time when all the offices are full and teeming with new businesses or legacy businesses that are using them. So I think this is a really important dynamic to understand, that what we call ZIRP, I mean, the reason interest rates were low is because the economy was poor and the Fed was trying to stimulate the economy. But the economy was poor also meant high unemployment. It also meant a lot of empty homes. It also meant a lot of vacant office space. So if you think about even like the sweet greens and stuff of that era, to some extent, it was probably about the new rise of different millennial tastes and millennials in the workforce and various things like that. But also, you know, cheap online ordering and abundant labor and all these other things that are sort of like
a chicken and egg thing, though, too, right?
That's because right.
Which came first, the millennial focused startups or millennial taste?
Yeah, that's for you to answer. I don't know. That's for you to.
Oh, because I'm a millennial. No. Wait, yeah, are you an elder?
So my definition of millennial Gen X cutoff is: did you have Facebook in college? Because I didn't, and I think that's like a really important, like that's like a really defining aspect of like that sort of like, were you an adult when this certain mode of interacting was? We did not at the University of Texas. I graduated in 2002. We did not have Facebook at all then. So therefore, I do not consider myself a millennial. It's others can disagree, but I think that's like a pretty, I find that to be a useful way to think about it.
That's interesting. I'm like a millennial Gen Z cusp. I was born in 94, and I would translate that to because I had Facebook when I got to high school. I got it in ninth grade, right? And so I wonder if then the Gen Z cutoff is like, did you have Facebook at all? Or like, did you have it in middle school?
Well, I think that's a good one. The other thing is, so you graduated from high school in 2009, you said?
2012. I was in 2012. Ninth grade in 2009. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I also think probably the rise of like mobile social networking is its own distinct phase. So there's probably something around there with it. Like the fact that for Gen Z, the internet is the phone primarily. Mm-hmm. Probably could be a similar way to think about that cutoff. I don't know, but I think it's a good question. Anyway, just to finish the thought on interest rates, like a big thing that happens when the Fed cuts rates is that like mortgage rates go down, except that mortgage rates have been falling for a year and a half because everyone sort of had known that inflation had peaked sometime, I guess, in middle of 2022. So as inflation started to come down, people started thinking, okay, at some point the Fed is going to cut. So the key thing I would argue is that actually very little happens on the day of the rate cut announcement because everyone's, if you're writing a mortgage 3 weeks ago, you already know that. Yeah, it's priced in, which actually, Daisy, maybe actually vindicates your point. Maybe it really is just a Twitter thing. Now that I think about it, I think you're actually right that when it comes to the actual day of the rate cut announcement, maybe the only story is the memes and what people are talking about it, because from a financial market standpoint, everyone knew it was coming. It was sort of more or less priced in. There was some ambiguity, 25 versus 50, and we could talk about why that's significant, what they chose. But to some extent, it was like the event and people talking about it, perhaps more than the change in the price of overnight money that actually mattered on that day when it was announced.
Well, but it impacts the economy, very, 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 very small sector of the economy that is emotion-based investments and vibes-based investments. Like going back to ZIRP, money was free for people building technical software businesses, which are primarily theoretical until they are not. And then, but you're making the point, like there's all these things in the world that were actual physical conditions of surplus.
Yeah.
That we have to count, like Airbnb was a surplus of housing, like gig economy is a surplus of labor, Facebook is a surplus of hot people. So, way, like for anything that is actually tangible, yes, the rate cut was probably already priced in, but for the small, small number of people who are like disproportionately loud, hello, Mark Andreessen.
Yeah.
That now gives them the permission to make the emotional investments that they were always going to make, but now they have an alibi for it, which is this specific financial point.
So I think here's a key point that relates to sort of the VCs and the market addresses of the world, which is real and which sort of does connect back to the very recent Fed rate decision. I think what really matters is the stock market. Because ultimately, if you're funding a startup, there are two ways you can monetize that, which is one, the company could one day go public, or two, sell to a public company, usually with that acquisition in share price. And so the level of the stock market at any given time is hugely important. Mm-hmm. And the one reason that the rate cut, so on the day after the Fed decision was on Wednesday, the tech stocks surged like 3% the Thursday afterwards. And one thing that sort of like gets into the economics, so there was this debate going into rate cut day, are they going to do 50 or are they going to do 25? If they were in 25, then that would have signaled a like we're being cautious here. We're like
50 being we're, half a percentage point, 25.
That's right.
A quarter
that's
of
right.
a percentage on
that's
the,
right.
the rate. Yeah.
And so what 50 symbolizes is, you know, we're very serious about now whether they're going to be successful is a separate question, but it's a signal. We're very serious about doing whatever we can to forestall a recession. And recessions almost always coincide with a decline in the stock market. We're very serious about cutting off the prospect of a recession. We are no longer so concerned about inflation such that, you know, like a year ago, they might have said, you know what? A recession is an okay price to pay for killing inflation. By going 50 at this most recent meeting, they're basically saying, we're really not concerned that much about inflation anymore at all. Our main priority is forestalling that recession. So then you saw that the stock market take off. And then you say the trickle down effect from that to the real economy is probably some greater impulse on the part of investors to say, okay, this end machine, the stock market, that determines the degree to which we can monetize our investments, it's up. And therefore, that would have at the margin some impulse to like, okay, we're going to write checks to startups. So I do think it matters in that respect.
Another topic I am not so informed on, but I know you are, and I would love to hear kind of explained, is Linacon. So this is somebody that like I wasn't too aware of until this summer when she kind of came up in this, you know, the conversation about like J.D. Vance was kind of saying he likes her, and then progressives were saying he likes her. I listened to your episode with her last November. Yeah. Explain to me like who she is and why there's kind of this horseshoe theory or like horseshoe meeting where like people on the far left and people on the far right are both kind of fans.
She's the FTC chief. Yeah, she's the FTC chief, which plays this big role in approving or not approving mergers. Historically speaking, you know, obviously there's a long history of antitrust in the U.S., and that's an important aspect of how capitalism works in the U.S. There are anti-monopoly. Historically speaking, this is not an area that I'm that expertise on, but this is my understanding, which is that historically speaking, the reason we don't like monopolies in this country is because monopolies can raise consumer prices, and that's bad.
Yeah.
And there's been this sort of change, probably picking up over the last decade, but this gets to a little bit where I'm a little unsure on, but there's been this change in thinking about antitrust where it's like, no, consumer prices are just one bad aspect of monopoly or concentrated power or of oligopoly, et cetera. And there are other things that we don't like about concentrated corporate power. So we don't like the fact that if there's only a few dominant players, then maybe they can suppress wages because your workers have fewer options about who they're going to work for. Maybe we don't like the fact that really powerful companies could contribute to reasons not to start a company at all. So it's like if you had a better idea for a search engine, for example, and you might think, you know what, it just doesn't matter because the existing search market is monopolistic or not, then maybe you just don't ever start that company in the first place. So I think Lina Khan's appointment to run the FTC is essentially this sort of success story for this different way of this more expansive way of thinking about antitrust. And if you're a VC, you might not like it because, as I mentioned a minute ago, one of the ways you monetize your investments is by selling them to large companies. And if the top regulator of mergers and acquisitions in this country is less inclined to approve deals, it's exactly right. Then you're going to have a harder time selling your company or whatever. So I think like to your question about the horseshoe, I mean, look, I think we're sort of in this era. It's a good question. And I genuinely don't know the answer, like how much is just rhetoric and how much is just sort of like populist posturing. That's for other people to determine. Some people would say this is just, you know, we're in a moment where there seems to be a lot of political capital in attacking elites or, you know, power, regardless of what perspective you have. I don't know, like, again, how much is sincere, how much, say, in a Trump-Vance administration, that line would continue to be pursued. I genuinely couldn't begin to speculate. But you can see why there are people on different parts of the spectrum who, at least in theory, like the idea of a regulator who is going to make it harder to consolidate corporate power.
Well, and progressives too, one of the concerns is like antitrust legislation has also been applied to labor unions themselves.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, there's a point at which we sort of jumped the shark by saying, actually, we can have price fixing in labor.
That's
too.
Right.
And so the way that these laws are applied is also of interest to people who are, you know, quote, anti-capitalist, where it's like, it's not trust theory as it pertains to business, but actually trust theory as it pertains to labor as well.
Totally. And I think, like, in the same way that being vocally in support of Lina Khan and this new approach to antitrust has some sort of bipartisan valence, criticism does too. And so you have people who are more on the left side of the dial is like, no, we should just get back to focusing on prices and just apply the old test. And then, of course, you have the sort of traditional business right, et cetera. And there, it gets even more complicated, of course, because you have a lot of these VC types who probably don't, who maybe, I don't know, they're a little bit incoherent, perhaps, because on the one hand, they're upset about their deals falling through, but maybe emotionally, they still sort of like the idea of a harder line on power, prominent VC type tweeters and so forth. So I don't know where it's going. It'll be interesting to see, regardless, like after this election, whether this particular strain of antitrust thinking carries over. I think that's like a pretty big open question, to be honest.
But also it depends like what stage of investments you make, because if you're early stage, your exit is other VCs.
Right.
Exit capital is other VCs. And so I feel like if you're the last one holding the bag, then you're concerned about IPO. But I think that that's, I mean, maybe early stage and late stage can explain some of the political schism as well.
Yeah, I'm sure.
VC Twitter. And I see Francis has written down for you, and I have to ask him where this comes from. I assume maybe a previous episode that he wants to ask you about the current state of yuppies.
Oh, okay.
Oh, interesting. Well, wait.
So here's what I actually, I just read this book, Triumph of the Yuppies, America, the 80s, and the Creation of an Unequal Nation. I think it came out this summer by this guy, Tom McGrath. And it's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like a light history, a fun read. It's like
Chase. It sounds very David Brooks.
It's about the 80s, and like Jerry Rubin like Jack Welch and shareholder primacy and it's you know, corporate hostile takeover, et cetera. But I'm more interested in talking about this in a very casual sense of like, does the yuppie still exist? Like, kind of the thesis of this book ends up being that, like, well, like, the yuppie doesn't exist because it's like, it's everything now. We're all yuppies. Like, yuppies won, et cetera. I don't know. Do you think yuppies still exist? Or like, what is yuppiedom? Whereas in the 80s, it was this very clear thing that was talked about. Is it a thing now?
I love this curveball. I was not expecting this. And there's part of me is like, I have no idea. But here's something I do think about, which I don't know if it's going to directly answer your question. But, you know, one of these things that comes up in the political fights over and over again is you have a lot of, say, like, I would say wealthy, powerful people on the right talking about like elites. Right. And then there's usually this counterpoint is like, no, you're elite. You're a successful business person, et cetera. And it's like, no, like, objectively speaking, you who runs this VC firm or you who runs a large media organization headquartered in New York City, by any objective definition, you are elite, right? So what are you even talking about like elites? But on the other hand, there's something there, like, is what I think. Like, there's something there. There is some class of people that I think is usually sort of liberal-leaning professionals in the world, more on the coasts, et cetera, who are probably largely Democrats, who have us. And it, I don't know if it's like necessarily, many of them probably aren't even well paid, but are in some sense sort of like influential elites. I kind of have this theory that like everyone really at heart, and I think you see this with the rise of like prominent hedge funders who've gotten into posting, et cetera, like money is great. Political influence is great, but what people really want is to be taken seriously as a poster. Like, if you had one of those like pyramids, you know, of like the different basic things. The Maslow's high. Like, at the base of it is desire to be taken seriously for your tweets. And I just sort of think that like this is like the sort of core thing that we've all discovered, which is it really doesn't matter how rich and influential you are, it doesn't matter like what politicians you have on speed dial, et cetera. If no one takes your tweet seriously, you're probably frustrated and annoyed and think you deserve to have them taken seriously. And so I don't know if it's like about yuppies per se, but this is something I think about, which is that there are people, maybe like the three of us, for whom like their posts get taken seriously, and then there are people far richer than us and people joke about their, you know, is there like, oh,
yeah. Well, your prank. Whole thing you're saying there is like, that's arguably like why Elon Musk bought Twitter, right? Which we don't need to like, that's a whole can of worms, but
yeah. Problem,
yeah.
Francis, yes. Did this book get into kind of the moment at which financial and political power and cultural power started to diverge? Because I think what we're really getting at
that's
here
right,
is
like that's right. That's envy. What we're talking about here.
There's this fundamental envy between the left and the right. Obviously, I'm not the person. I didn't come up with this. A lot of people have said, like, the right has political power, some cases financial power, but they want cultural power. The left has cultural power, but they want political power. And then we see a parallel playing out, especially on X. The media has cultural power, but they want financial power. Tech has financial power, but they want cultural power. There's no way to shortcut the two.
Yeah.
You know, the problem is, you know, people complain. I had this realization sometime last year, which is a thing like, why isn't the mainstream media covering this? And then you'll find like, oh, no, the mainstream media did cover this.
Yeah.
Really what they're upset about is that, Daisy, you haven't tweeted about it and acknowledged about it, because you're like this sort of, you know, someone like you, someone like us, we're like the stand-in. They're really not upset that like ABC News or CNN didn't cover the story. They probably did cover the story, or certainly some mainstream outlet actually did cover it. It's more just like, no, they really want you to acknowledge this and like bow down and sort of like accept, no, this is a thing. And until you talk about the thing that they want you to talk about, I think they'll be unsatisfied.
So another thing,
another
thing that's coming back to me as we talk about this with the book that like was a big takeaway for me was like the way I like think of buying stuff, or like going to restaurants where it's like resi culture and restaurants and, you know, restaurants in New York booked 3 weeks out, you can't get a seat. And like this book kind of like suggesting that like that wasn't a thing before the 80s. Like you would just go to a restaurant to like get a meal. You're not, there's no like restaurant hype, and like you're not like buying the, you know, the name brand designer thing. And I don't know, look, I was not alive in the 70s. Well, so I don't know.
I deeply have to say something. I'm so sorry. Say it. My favorite movie, When Harry Met Sally, one of my favorite scenes.
'Tis the season.
When she, Carrie Fisher's character quotes, what's his name? Bruno Kirby's character to him. The line that she quotes is, restaurants are to the 80s what theater was to the 60s.
Right? Oh, that's good.
Or something like that. So even at the time that shift was happening, people were talking about like, why are restaurants our culture? Like, why do we go to restaurants now instead of going to theater?
Well, so what's funny
too, food is really good.
What's the name of the guy who wrote Bright Lights, Big City?
Jay McInerney, columnist.
I just listened to, he was just on How Long Gone last week, and I listened to that episode, and he was saying how restaurants now have replaced what nightclubs were in the 80s. So,
right, well, my father-in-law is going to kill me. Well, no, he doesn't listen to this. So my father-in-law went to Williams with Jay McInerney.
Yeah.
Jay McInerney somehow talked himself into a higher level philosophy class as like an undergrad and would pontificate and chain smoke. And so
another time.
Yeah. So my father-in-law, that's just like Jay McInerney. Like I was in class with him. He was not qualified to be there. And all he did was chain smoke, which I guess now is like a cool thing to do. But I guess like I'm wondering, like, is the reason we don't see yuppies now because you have to like choose a lane where you can be a cultural yuppie, or you could be a financial yuppie, but you, or like I want to be rich yuppie, but you can't really be both because the behaviors of one is so cringe to the other.
Yeah. Which is like the death of the bohemian.
Bobos in paradise.
This is a good question. I don't know. Can I just say like I really like food. I like going out to eat. I never have a problem. There's a million restaurants in New York City. I just walk into them all the time. So,
this is so
whenever,
refreshing, Joe. Thank
whenever
you.
I see there's like discourse about, oh, you can't get into a restaurant,
you're like, just go to any other of the
just
10,000.
Go to literally any other restaurant. We live in New York City. We have so many amazing restaurants in New York City. I never have any issues getting amazing food in a restaurant if I want to on any given night. So, I have to say, maybe it's because, you know, I've been married since for 18 years now. Maybe if I were single and dating, I would have some other pressure or something like that. But if people are really worried, trust me, there's plenty of good restaurants out there. It's the it's the best city in the world. Just walk out your door and you'll find one in 2 minutes.
Well, okay, so this goes back, I think, again, to something like this. The kind of final nail in this yuppie conversation, I think, is when we were talking to the industry guys, Mickey and Conrad, a couple weeks ago.
Can we just talk industry for the rest of the show?
Yes, it's on the list.
Okay.
Industry.
Okay. Yeah, I know it's on the list. I know.
So,
all right, perfect seg, perfect seg.
So they were talking about, like, maybe I read this in, maybe it was the interview we had, or maybe it was another thing I read. But anyways, they were talking about how, like, for millennials, you know, there's still this fraught idea of selling out and, like, not wanting to sell out. But with Gen Z, it's like, that's, you don't even think about that because, like, you know, you monetize yourself and, like, you need to get the money. You have, like, you know, if you want to get to buy the stuff, which of course you want to buy the stuff, you have to get the money, you have to get a good job, etc. And you're like, you know, you're monetizing yourself on Instagram, whatever. I don't know. I guess the question is, like, do you agree that, like, there's this, like, generational shift towards, like, being less, like, shameful about money, about wanting to make money?
Yeah, I think so. It certainly feels like it. And I, you know, when I early, you know, when I was in high school in the early 90s, and there were just endless articles in various zines I would read about punk bands, and they're like, oh, you signed with a major label. Yeah. You've sold out, et cetera. And it really does feel like that whole discourse is completely dead. I guess I'm just going to be really old and say, I wish people still had a little bit more shame. I wish there was still, a little bit of shame left. And I wish that there were still this idea that if you're making money on something, there's probably a good chance that you've made it bland or you've sort of appealed to the lowest common denominator. I'd like to go back to sellout discourse, at least turn the dial a little bit, because it really does feel too, which is that, and I know that there's all this for the last several years, probably over a decade now, this sort of debate about, like, in the music, you know, and you poptimism in the music, and this idea that, like, is the best music also the most popular? And it used to be sort of embarrassing to be really into the bands or the individual musicians that were at the very top of the list. And now people are sort of self-consciously cool about the fact that they listen to people who are absolutely gigantic. And I don't know, I kind of wish that went away a little bit, but I think that's real. I think what you've described, this certain alignment of monetary success with what's cool or whatever, is absolutely true and has changed a lot in my lifetime.
What if I want to buy a Rivian?
Go, you should get it. I think that's cool looking.
I might have to sell out a little bit though.
Oh yeah, that's fine.
I think the poptimism pendulum has swung back a little bit. Maybe I'm just thinking of that myself. Like, I remember, like, going into college, I was such a, like, you know, I only like what I like. And then I'm like, oh, it's okay to like pop music, etc. And then now I think I'm, like, swinging back to, like, oh no, I need to have, like, harsher opinions on X cultural product, or, like, it's okay to have those. I don't need to, like, think everything is
good. You have
to
kill the Portland inside of you.
Yeah, kill the Portland.
So I solved this problem for myself. I threaded this needle in a way that feels very satisfying to me by getting, like, really into country music. And so I like all of the top artists who are from Nashville, all of, like, the pop country artists, but they're just a little bit, you know, tilted to the dial of, like, the absolute mainstream. So I can be like, oh, I'm really into who's that guy that did Fast Car? Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. So I really love the latest Luke Combs album, which actually I really do, and it's really good. So I solved this problem because most people probably aren't listening to the entire Luke Combs album, so I can be a little bit cooler than everyone
by being into this album, at least.
In New York. I'm just talking about in my circle. So I can be a little bit cooler than everyone by being actually knowing the entirety of the Luke Combs album while also being into someone who is objectively a megastar. And so I recommend that country solves this problem for
Are we going to talk about Light Sweet Crude?
Yeah, yes.
Are we going to talk about Harper and Yasmin?
Since selling it out is okay, go to Spotify and listen to my country band Light Sweet Crude. We have 2 4-song EPs up there.
I listened to
both EPs, and then I also found your SoundCloud, which has a lot of, let's say, B-sides. I don't know, particularly a lot of Christmas songs. What's your deal with all these Christmas songs?
Well, all the great Christmas songs, I think, were written by Jews. If I so I feel like I should continue that. You know what? I'll just say one thing, which is one thing I like about Christmas songs and country music. And there's a lot of crossover. One thing that like attracts me as someone who is a hobbyist musical artist, I like genres that are very constricted. So in country, there's basically only three things you can sing about. So you can sing about like drinking and drugs, heartbreak, and then small towns on a Friday night. And those are basically the only three topics you're allowed to sing about on country. And you're really only allowed to use three or four chords before sonically it's no longer country anymore. And so I find it sort of satisfying, like, to work within such a constrained genre where the challenge is how do you fit something new into such a tight box? And therefore, I think Christmas songs appeal to me in the same way, where it's like, how do you say something new about Christmas? Anyway, that's just...
Low-carb that's Christmas.
Yeah, or Merry Christmas. I'm proudest of Merry Christmas from the Exit Row, which I think George Strait could do. Anyway, enough shamelessly plugging me.
And you're putting together the soundtrack for season 4 of Industry.
There you go.
We have a great band for the Christmas episode.
That's right.
There is always a Christmas episode.
Always a Christmas episode. So what do you think of this season, Joe? Is somebody
I'm obsessed with it. Yeah. It's so good. I love this show. Like, I love the show. Someone tweeted about this. I didn't actually see the tweet. My wife told me about the tweet and I couldn't find it, but it was something like, I have no idea what's going on in the episodes, but I still like it. And that's kind of how I feel, because it's probably one of the first shows in a while that I actually pay attention to. Because I'm a bad TV watcher. I scroll my phone and look at Twitter while I watch TV. But I actually pay attention to Industry. I actually pay attention to the TV, but there are still many scenes where I'm like, what exactly is going on here? I don't really understand. But it doesn't really matter, and I'm not really sure why. It's so good. But I'm so riveted.
I think some people don't understand because of the jargon. You obviously understand the jargon. You're just like not some tracking the characters, right?
Yeah, I'm not tracking the characters. You know, the thing is there are some things that I don't think just objectively make any sense from the financial standpoint. Well, I just find it hard to believe that like a bank would have this huge wall of debt that was coming due and that they can't pay it and that would be some surprise.
This like, 150-year-old bank,
Yeah, like there would presumably lots of analysts who have a deep understanding of the bank's balance sheet. I just find it to be kind of implausible that could be something that would be overlooked by anyone.
First-year student finds this out who's like 21. Yeah.
I find things like that implausible. There's another element, too, where things are talked about, like events take place in the macro economy that they then trade on. Like, I don't know, the Bank of England will raise some rates and then they make some trade on the pound. Like, there's no way this caught anyone by surprise in the market, et cetera. So my efficient markets head finds some of these things to be a little bit implausible. But that's okay. I don't really mind it too much, but there is sort of like there is a little bit of things like there's just no way that they weren't all aware of these various moving pieces, so that part I find a little bit sus. But and then there's just various interpersonal things where I'm thinking to myself, I genuinely don't understand exactly what's happening here between the characters, but I still love the show, and it's the first show in probably years that I've got genuinely addicted to, where I want to
like watch on Sunday night.
Yeah, watch on Sunday night. I think my favorite one so far, I guess it was it was the one after Lumi collapsed and they had that hearing and then they all went back to the club and the energy and they were all there and the head of the newspaper there, because I have to say that comports so much with my perception of entire how England or the UK works, which is that they all know each other. You know, my co-host Tracy Alloway, she went to college at London School of Economics. My friend who works here at Bloomberg, Sid Verma, I think he went to Oxford and he went to some prep school in the UK. And everyone knows each other in the UK. Yeah. They're all like, oh yeah, I went to uni with that person. And you look up and some new minister will be there like, oh yeah, I went to uni with them. They all went to uni with each other. And so my perception, the UK is just run by this little club of political people, finance people, and media who all know each other. I was like, oh, I love this episode so much because it confirms all my stereotypes of how I think the UK is basically run.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. What are your favorite episodes? I think the whole thing's great.
I mean,
We've both already seen it.
We finished it.
Oh, you've seen the whole thing. So oh, I'm so jealous.
The finale. Oh yeah, don't tell. I can't say anything about it. But I will say the Rishi episode. The Rishi episode was like.
I was just gonna. Yeah.
But with have you seen Good Time? The movie by
I love Good Time.
To me, it's like that. I was so stressed out. I don't know if I ever want to watch it again, but like it was so good. But I don't. I just don't know if I can subject myself to it again.
No, the Rishi episode was great because it didn't quite end. Like it ended in this very satisfying, unexpected way because you think like, okay, this guy is truly at the end of his rope. He's dug in so deep. There is no way out of this hole, this gambling hole that he's got himself into. So, you know, we're staring down. This is a disaster for this character. And then you realize at the end, no, he just loves the game. And so even though he got beat up, even though he lost all this money, you could just tell at the end that the entire experience of that whole affair was extremely satisfying to him personally. And this is why he's in it, because obviously this sort of pushes a button for him that he really needs in his life, like this level of stress and drama. And then, which I think I suspect is probably a certain character archetype that you would find on many trading floors, probably a little less than people think, because I think trading is a little less exciting these days than it was before the great financial crisis. There's probably fewer of those Rishi characters at major banks. Maybe they'd be at hedge funds these days. But I found that to be a sort of deeply stressful but also satisfying episode, and so extremely well done.
Daisy, what about yours?
If it was Conrad or Mickey who said like you get the same amount of dopamine from losing as you do winning, I don't know if that's technically true scientifically, but it definitely is like, well, there's just the dopamine hit from playing the game.
Period. Well, I played some poker with my friends on Saturday night, and I will say I did leave the table with $0, and it was a thrill to lose all my money.
This is, I've actually been playing more poker this year. I've gotten back into it. And one reason that I know that I'm not going to be a poker addict, I'm not that good. I'm trying to get better, but I usually lose more than I make. But I know that I have very little risk of addiction, because I find it deeply unsatisfying. Like, I'm embarrassed when I lose a big hand and I want to slink away. I have no impulse to be double down. I'm like, oh, I'm embarrassed that this happened. Everyone just saw me make a bad call. I don't want that. Whereas I play with people who are just the exact opposite. They lose and they're like, oh, I'm buying back in for $1,000or give me $2,000 worth of chips. I don't have that impulse. It makes me not want to play.
I don't want to play at a casino. I just like to do it to like sit with my friends for like 6 hours and like shoot the shit, right? Like I've never played in a casino. I don't think I ever will.
I like the casino vibe. I was out in California recently, and it's probably bad because like I'm out there. I was there for work, and there are in theory people I could have met and had drinks with. But there was this car. There are lots of card rooms in Southern California, so I'm just like, I'll see you guys tomorrow morning. I'm gonna go. Play cards. There's something about the anonymity of it in a casino where everyone's just there. I kind of like. But to your point, there is this really good book about poker called Positively Fifth Street. But I think it's by this author James McManus, where he talks about his experience in the World Series of Poker and his experience knowing poker players. And he talks about this friend of his, and I want to try to keep it PG for the people listening, but who essentially would get into a state of sexual arousal upon losing a lot of money. And that there was some like sort of like turn on, like, you know, literally turned them on. So I could see there are definitely people in the world for whom losing money is level. Just as satisfying as making a lot of money.
Well, yeah. I think this there you go. Very dark. I think the show has obviously produced a lot of interesting memes and is operating on a level that's actually very humorous and lighthearted, and as the creator said, like funnier almost than past seasons.
Totally.
But I think, well, it's a classic comedy and drama, right?
That's right.
It's like, oh, the bear's a comedy, whatever. It's like, why are we even having this conversation around the bear? Like, let's have this conversation around industry, because
that's right. Hey, industry, the bear. The bear is totally joyless. I was not a fan of this most recent series because I finished it, but like every episode and every conversation is just so heavy. And every time they cut a tomato or something, it's like this big, long discussion about some trauma that the person had when they cut a tomato 10 years ago. I just want to see them eat tasty food and cook tasty food, because that's fun, that's joyful.
Yeah.
And so I do think that like industry is good because it's really stressful and dark, but it's also joyful because they have the fun of it and they have the excitement, where I think the Bear this season totally missed all of it.
Well, totally. And like, I rewatched Margin Call recently because my husband hadn't seen it. I kept telling him you have to see it. The first time I watched Margin Call, I was laughing out loud. I was like, Margin Call is a comedy. And I rewatched it because I had already watched this season of Industry with the episode that just aired, which obviously has a lot of...
Which is the penultimate episode, right?
I think. Penultimate episode has a lot of, to me, references to Margin Call. And Margin Call being, in my mind, a comedy, like going back and watching it, you know, the darkest thing that happens is like Kevin Spacey's like burying his dog as like a metaphor for the American market. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, whatever. It's kind of camp in retrospect. But there's nothing in Margin Call as dark as that Eric Bill moment. Mm. And that was genuinely like dark television. And Conrad and Mickey were like, we had like, it was hard on set to film this scene.
The first episode they directed also.
That it was, it was painful.
Well, you know what? I actually did not finish. You know what? I still have about 15 minutes to go from Sunday. Sorry. Okay. All right.
On the podcast, unprepared. What?
Sorry. You're right. You know what? I watched it last night and I was like 15 minutes ago and I was really tired. But anyway, Alpha, now I know that there is this very dramatic Eric and Bill.
Okay.
On this note, this is Tasteland. See you next week.
Sorry.
No.
Okay. Wait. Actually, I do have at least one more question. Okay. So you've tweeted a lot. You have like nearing 500,000 tweets. You're famously a Twitter addict.
Yes.
Don't pocket watch him.
I look. But okay. You were tweeting today about the devolution of Twitter, how it predates Elon Musk, etc. I was wondering if you're like actually considering any other platforms. You last posted on Threads in January, so I don't think you are. I think you're kind of just Rishi moding it and just,
you know what,
the game. But
I opened Blue Sky today. Opened Blue Sky today for the first time, and this is a tough one. You know, I don't think I'm that close, but I must be closer. It's just, there's so many. In the last several weeks, I've started to wonder why I subject myself. I think that. Turtleism, which is just what I feel every time I open Twitter now, because there's just so much sociopathic, misanthropic lies, racism of every variety. And I start to wonder, is there like a great reason for me to subject myself? I would still bet on myself not really getting hooked on another platform, but I have to admit, like, I kind of think it's taking a little bit of a toll on me to just sort of open it every time and just see the sheer amount of slop that is now overtaken that site and like wonder, am I really getting anything? But then every once in a while, like you think of something really clever and you have a great post and it gets a bunch of retweets like, oh, this is why we're in the game. You know, this is why we love posting.
And like that has been totally a favorite day. Like, is there like a day like or like an event? Probably, and favorite maybe is the wrong word, because oftentimes the best days on Twitter aren't about good things. They're actually about terrible things. I don't know. Maybe not. I was trying to think if I have like,
you know, speaking of, since it actually connects to Industry, late 2022 when Liz Truss, the Prime Minister of the UK, unveiled her emergency budget or whatever, and the pound plunged, etc. Like, that was a fun day for me, because for me, there's a lot of meat there. There's like, let's talk about the mechanics of how currencies work. Let's talk about the relationships of deficits and rates. Let's talk about the interest of fiscal policy and monetary policy. And then you layer in all the politics and all the memes. So I think those are like thick, meaty days. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. The lettuce. So, okay, like, those are, like, the kind of moments that I think, like, for
nobody
me, there's a lot there.
On the pound dropping because it was already priced in.
In the show or in real life?
In real life, you just said trust. In the show, it's unrealistic. Nobody would be trading
That part was a truly, a genuinely, unlike a typical Bank of England decision, like, that was a genuinely surprised thing, and it took a while to figure out. And it was another good thing about it, and it sort of harkens back to what actually genuinely made Twitter great in the 2010s. And this is really important, is that the other thing that happened on that day is there were a handful of people that actually knew what they were talking about on that day. And there were people that understood the liability structure of the UK pension system and could talk about how that interaction and the pension funds got margin called and could actually explain something. So, you know, there's a lot of garbage on that site, a lot of memes. Some of them are all right. But also for years, it was an amazing place where someone could have expertise who might not be a columnist at a major newspaper or whatever. And they could air, they could teach you something unmediated. And that is really what made the site great. And to some extent still does. But a lot of those people, I think, have sort of given up, and you just don't get that as often. Or you get these people that think they know something and do these big 25 threads and 25 tweet threads, and they have no idea what they're talking about. But there was sort of a golden age where, like, wow, I'm like discovering people's insight that I would never have gotten on any other major platform immediately. And that was a good example of it. But there are fewer and fewer far between these days. And that's kind of sad.
I'm calling it now, the next sort of thread expert we're going to see rise up. We're going to about to witness the ascendance of the nuclear energy poster.
Oh, yeah. There's a new solar energy bro that I'm really excited about, actually. Yeah, I know. By the way, I'm getting ahead of this, which is that being sort of a nuke bro is becoming a little cringe, actually. I'm gonna be one step ahead here. Mm-hmm. So that I think that, like, now, like, if you're just sort of like a true, like, pure nuke bro, that's like a little bit 2023. And now, like, the sort of even more sophisticated is like, yes, nukes, but also there is a role for solar, and that's not just some like hippie liberal dream. Yeah. So the nuke bro, I think, is like a little bit dated now. I'm just gonna take the other side here.
So I live close enough to Indian Point that they have to send me literature to my house every year telling me where I can pick up potassium pills.
Oh, that, I love that.
How to evacuate.
Do you have some?
No. Come on, man.
Do you need some?
If it's my time, it's my time. No, but if they reopen Indian Point, like, do I have to move? I don't know.
No, they're safe. You won't have to move. They're safe. We recorded a really good episode that touches on some of this stuff. So it'll be out next week.
By the way, a little point from last episode where I said somebody should have a podcast on the Big Dig. WGBH did an excellent audio series.
Oh, that sounds good. That sounds good.
So if that sounds good to you and you want to learn more about the Big Dig, WGBH, if you want to learn more about why it's okay for me to live across the river from Indian Point, what's the Odd Lots episode called?
It'll be out next week. I can't say the guest because there's some news that's enough. But it'll be out this coming Monday. So it's really good. And we talk about this stuff. But we touch on a lot of this. And one thing I learned from our guest is that if you poll people about approval for nuclear, it's actually much higher in the neighborhoods that there is a nuclear power plant than in places where there isn't a nuclear power plant, which is one reason why, if we think there's going to be a nuclear renaissance in the U.S., which there might be because they recently announced the restarting of a Three Mile Island reactor, it's probably going to be more restarting of reactors at existing sites than brand new facilities, because the politics is actually fairly good in the place where nuclear already exists.
Well, because they're like, oh, my grandpa works there and put forth.
That's right.
School.
Yeah. That's right. They're good jobs, and a lot of them are unionized workforce. And so they actually enjoy a fair amount of popular support in the areas that they exist.
I think let's end it right there. We'll plug that. Listen to Odd Lots on Monday for a great episode about nukes. This has been Tasteland. Thank you.
This has been really fun. Thank you so much for having me.